Hey, what's up, guys? My name is Alex. Welcome back to Gray Area. And I'm here with DJ, producer, and all-around badass, Kyle Watson. What's up, man?
How you doing, man? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time out to speak to us today. We're super excited to have you in New York next month.
I'm like super, super pumped to come back out there, dude. It's been on the cards for a long time, and it's been one of my favorite cities to play. So, yeah, I'm looking very forward to being back.
Absolutely, man. Funny enough, I was looking back at your catalog when getting ready, and for the Into the Morning remix album, I was actually working unofficially with This Ain't Bristol at the time, and I did an email interview with you for that, for Magnetic Mag. So, yeah, like, and then I looked further back, even further than that, and I saw that you had, like, a bunch of releases on, like, old Fidget House labels, like Potty Mouth. And I kind of want to, like, start there. You told us the last time you interviewed with us that you had several years of, like, hit or miss releases, and you didn't just have several years. You had, like, a prolific output of music, like, the entire time you've been doing this. Like, how long did it take you to land on this really distinct sound that you have, and how did you arrive there?
It's crazy that you bring up Potty Mouth and that whole era, because, like, when I talk to people now, it's just like that doesn't even come up at all. It's like that feels like it was so long ago, honestly. So I started releasing music around 2007, I think. And at the time, it was like this, you know, it's kind of like Fidget House was coming up, and it was really interesting. It was that, like, people were making music that was so weird, you know, like people hadn't heard this type of stuff before, and the sounds that people were creating and everything. Like, Potty Mouth was a label that was just like championing that stuff. They were like a big driver in the scene. So those sounds were like, you know, those were like, I've never heard these before. Like, I want to make music like this. I want to create sounds like this. And so that was where everything kind of started for me. Like, when you think about, like, how, you know, how the music got to where it is today, the starting point was,
yeah,
like the buzziness and the weirdness and like the wobbiness and like the interesting, like, sort of like different approach to drums as opposed to, like, just, you know, straight up samples and the mangling of things and like changing the, like, the kind of feel and lo-fi and everything. All of that kind of stuff, I think, is, those have stayed as like central sort of drivers for me in my production. And they're like, those are still elements that I try and keep in the music today. I think it just, you know, with the, like, the arc of music, you know, dance music in the world and that kind of stuff, it just, I kind of try to keep those influences central to that, but while still, like, trying to, you know, keep everything kind of up to date with the trends and the tempos and kind of like where everything's going. So it's really interesting that you bring up the fidget days.
It's funny too, because I feel like a lot of people from that era that are still producing still maintained something central to that sound, that wonky weirdness and the off, like the asymmetrical sampling and like all of that stuff is still kind of central to the sound, but it's just evolved in terms of like how sound design and production has evolved as well.
Yeah, I think probably a lot of that stuff, because, you know, it was so new and different. There was a lot of stuff that was like very, very like ropey, like the production quality of a lot of the stuff was like not that great. Like I listened to a lot of the stuff that that I made like back at that time, and I go like, oh dude, and like, you know, it's really not that good. But like, I think with time, and I think this is like just generally within the music industry, especially dance, like it gets a little bit easier to make like good sounding music, like not necessarily the ideas, like that doesn't change. You still have to have like a good idea, but to make it actually sound like a big record and fuller and like, you know, more polished, I think that gets a little bit easier. So yeah, the guys who are still in it today are kind of like keeping those influences, but it just sounds like way more polished and neater and not as crazy.
Yes. I want to go back even further to talk about like your dad, who was in the music industry, and he's the one that kind of got you into production by bringing home some production software for you. What did your dad do in the music industry?
Yeah, he did everything. He started out playing in a band when he was like at school and went through like university and did all of that stuff and in a band. And then he did a few musical projects, like performance stuff, like public performance stuff. And then he started a record label. He started a publishing company. He opened up like recording studios, and that was what he and that was what he did for like most of my life, you know, growing up. So the introduction to like something like music production software just came from him. I mean, he just came home. He went to go and meet with like one of his like contacts or whatever at a music store, and he was like, hey, you know, like Kyle is like, you know, he's been playing piano for a while. Like maybe you've got something that he can mess around with. And it was like a piece of software that was like pre-made loops. And you just like kind of like formulated them into a record, you know, like everything was kind of in key.
Yeah, yeah. Like GarageBand or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. So like pre-made loops and stuff. And so I made records. with that software for years. Like it just never got boring. And then I like kind of like. Then he was like, okay, well, you know, you've done this, you know, he has like Fruity Loops, you know, FL Studio or Reason or whatever. I can't remember what the second one was, but now you got to like write your own sounds, your own melodies, and it all just kind of like built up from there.
It's interesting too, because your dad, like, not, he was like in the music industry. So it seems like he kind of served as not just like, he was like a mentor to you as well, like throughout over the years. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he still is. I mean, he's like, his arc and everything of, you know, being in the industry, starting in a band and then like going and opening up like a successful recording studio and running a successful record label and everything. It's like, it's kind of crazy because like here I am, starting out playing the piano, going into music production, like last month or 2 months ago, like starting a record label with my wife. It's like it's crazy, dude. You know, it's very similar. It's a very similar kind of arc. And I mean, he's still there for me to ask advice and everything. And I'm like, I still get pumped to like show him some of the tracks that I work on and everything. So it's, it's very cool.
That's so awesome. Well, since you mentioned the record label, that was one of the things I wanted to talk about as well. I mean, you already have Box of Cats, which is kind of this landmark, really fun and groundbreaking label. What are you doing differently with No Context? Why did you decide to start something that's a little bit more Kyle Watson?
Yeah. So that's a good question. I mean, Box of Cats initially started as like this crazy combination of like six dudes' musical tastes. Like, let's just find, you know, we're not finding the music or the music that we all like really like from the influences back in the day. We were talking about Potty Mouth and everything. We all came from that era. So we were like,
right,
we're not finding music that have these influences. It's not coming out. Like there has to be stuff we can put out like this. So we decided to just do a free record label. It was never intended to be, you know, like a money-making, not necessarily a money-making thing, but like an income-based model.
Right.
It was never meant to be that. But I mean, it just grew, it picked up, people started really enjoying it. And we were like, let's turn this into an actual brand. And that's when we took it onto Beatport and started doing merch and stuff. But that's very much like a you know, multiple people involved, multiple tastes. It's already been running. It's been set up for a while. Starting a record label that's kind of like a little bit more tailored to sort of like my taste as an artist is something that I've been meaning to do for a while. And I mean, if I dig back into like Instagram and I look through the comments and stuff, people are like, just start a record label. When are you starting a record label? Like, you know, so I posted up a clip of Kick Drums, which was the first release. I think it was back in October, maybe last year. And I was like, maybe I should find a home for this record. And so many people came in and were like, just self-release it, start a record label. And that was almost like the catalyst to get it kicked off the ground. And I mean, like, it's quite cool because like I run it with my wife. So I'm like not very good at the organizational side of things. So like, I'm like very, very good at being a procrastinator. So, and she is the opposite. Like she's like super efficient. She gets stuff done. She keeps on top of everything. So it's quite nice that we're like a team in this kind of like venture, you know, and we walk in through the process together and stuff. And it's, we're really enjoying it, and we're looking forward to where it's gonna what it's gonna grow into.
That's so lovely that you get to not just, you know, finally do this thing, and you're also at the point in your career where you can do this and can be effective, but also that you get to work with your wife, who I know you've been with, who's kind of seen you through this entire evolution of your musical path.
100%. Yeah, you've done your research, dude. She's been she's you know, one of the reasons why I'm in this position today, to be honest. You know, like, you, this is a very difficult career. I mean, it has to be said, like, up front for the people around you. Like, it's not easy when you're touring and stuff, and you're away, you miss things, you're not always available. It's like in different time zones. It's very, very taxing on people and on relationships in general. So it has to be said that back in 2006, sorry, I met Tash, my wife, for the first time. And I mean, I was still messing around. I was just playing around with music at the time. Like, I never had any sort of like end goal of being a DJ or being a music producer or whatever. Like, I knew I enjoyed writing music, and you know, but yeah, I never saw myself as a DJ. I was like, okay, well, this is cool. Like, making music is fun and everything. And so, yeah, I played her some of my music, and her brother was a DJ at the time in South Africa, and he had a connection to two guys who had a record label there. And that was like my first releases came from that. And it all just built up from there. So like right from the beginning of my career in this industry, she's been there, like coming to the shows, listening to the music, giving me her thoughts on the music, like core to everything.
That's so cool. Like, that's so fantastic that, like, even just meeting her was kind of the catalyst for you getting into everything. That's kudos and props to her. Props to Tosh for sticking with you for this long, and for, you know, I've been in the music industry for like 20 years, and I've been with my wife for almost as long. And I will also say that if it wasn't for her staying on top of me and, you know, being in my corner and sticking through it, I wouldn't be where I am today. So I understand, like, that's a huge thing.
100%. Yeah. I think, I feel the exact same. It really, really helps to, it also keeps you grounded, you know, like things can run away with you. You know, when things are going well, you can, you know, it's easy to kind of like lose focus and stuff like that. And just the same when things are not going well, you know, there's big ups and downs in this business. So it really helps to have someone there who's like fighting for you in your corner and just like supporting you through it all. So yeah, we're very lucky that we
absolutely
have that.
100%. No, it's rare. It's very rare. So did she go with you to Coachella?
Of course she did. 100%. No way she's gonna miss that.
I hope not.
Yeah, no, it was.
Go ahead.
It was great because obviously you do Coachella, you do two weekends, you do two shows. So the first show we had to like get in, do the show, run, get back out to an afters back in LA. So it was like in and out. But what was cool about the second weekend is that we had friends come in from the UK. We had friends come in that live in Canada. We saw people we hadn't seen in a long time, and they all came in, and we had like this crew, and it was so good, honestly. It was really cool. And of course, yeah, Tash was going to be there. That's a given.
100%. What was it like? I mean, I know you were booked in 2020, and then everybody had the rug pulled out from under them. So what was it like to be able to come back? And let's be honest, you know, Sahara's cool. That's great. It's a big stage. But the Yuma has the most relevant people in-house and techno at hands down. Like, that is the place to play if you're playing underground house music and techno. So how was it to not just play there, but also play early and have like a full tent?
That is actually the craziest part for me. I mean, like, it goes without saying, you're playing in the Yuma, the production is ridiculous. The artists that you're playing around are like, you know, of course it's world class. Yeah, I think like that's a given. But when we got the slot, we were like, you know, this is cool. You know, playing Coachella, this is awesome. 2 p.m. It's like a Friday, you know, like, I don't know how many people are going to be there. You know, really, we had no idea. You know, we look at like previous years and try and gauge like how it was going to be. But really, we couldn't find any like info about how it was going to be. So we really walked in there not knowing if it was going to be amazing or if it was going to be like, you know, 150 people. But we're like, we're at Coachella, let's just freaking make the most of it. But yeah, it was ridiculous. I mean, like, we went in, We went in the first weekend before the doors had opened, right? So we went into the Yuma and we saw it completely empty, lights on, everything. And we were like, damn, like this is a big room. Like a lot of people in here at 2 p.m. on a Friday to make us feel nice and beefy. But, you know, went into the Yuma like 10 minutes before my set started. And I think there were probably like 4,000 people in there already. Chris Stussy was playing. And I was like, damn, okay, this is insane. And I mean, like I went on and I think within 15 minutes or so, they had to start like closing the doors because they got all like 6K people in there, you know, 6,000 people, and they couldn't let any more in. And I didn't know that at the time, but obviously I finished my set and my manager came up to me and he was like, dude, they closed the doors. They had to close the doors. And I was like, this is ridiculous. I mean, if it was going to be good, I didn't think it was going to be that good, you know? it was incredible. What an experience. Hey? And to do it like twice and have like the same result was just mind blowing. Yeah. So good.
How awesome. How fun to like, you know, finally, that's a huge checkbox in any musician's, you know, list is to play Coachella, and to do it with like, and have that many people be exposed to your music. That's incredible.
Yeah. It's 100% like, you know, like when I was playing, because before you go on, you know, you have like you've obviously got a little bit of nerves, you've got a little bit of like nervous sort of energy and stuff. So it's hard to like take in the fact that this is happening, you know, like, or look out
yeah.
at people and be like, damn, like I'm actually about to start this. Cause you're more like hyped up, you know, but it was like one point in the middle of the set where, you know, I was just like, took a pause and I just looked out at everyone and I was like, damn, like I actually cannot believe that I'm playing this set right now at this festival and there's this many people in front of me. Like, it was just absolutely mind blowing and an amazing opportunity and such a big box to tick for me.
100%. So, last year you went on your My Machines tour, and you came through San Francisco. I actually live in San Francisco, not New York, at the Midway. And that was the first time I saw you play live. Fantastic. Great job. But the tour was like kind of like a full circle moment for you, if you will, because you brought together like a 15-year library of music and something else that you do, which is motion animation. And I had no idea that you were even involved in the visual arts. This is a completely different facet to like your artistry. How did you get into that? And like, what was it like kind of bringing those two things together for the tour?
Yeah. So, I mean, how I got into like animation or video in general, I actually studied that at university, at college. So I've got a degree in that. And I, up until July 2021, I actually had a job doing that. So that's where that all came from. So it really helps, you know, for me, because I'm able to like make my own show visuals and do that kind of stuff. So we had someone come on to design like we had the vision, but we needed someone to come on and design like the actual elements and stuff, like the poster and everything.
Right.
So we had all of that done for us, but then I took like that and I turned some of the elements into those visuals that we played on the tour and stuff. So, that was the one side, and that was really cool. I mean, like, it was a lot of work and it was a lot of preparation and stuff, but I couldn't have been more happy with how the visual side came out. And like, yeah, the 15 years of like of jumping back into like the music catalog and everything. I'd done a show like this in South Africa when I lived in South Africa, because I live in the UK now, but back when I lived in South Africa, my home club that I played at called Truth, We did the first My Machines there, and it was really cool. You know, it was the town that I'd like grown up in and I'd been playing in for like, you know, 10 years or whatever. So a lot of the music people knew, you know, people would come out with, like, you know, even if it came out in like 2010 or whatever, you know, like people might go, oh, you know, like I remember that record. So there was an expectation for that, right? When I played in South Africa. So we did the first My Machines in America right before COVID. It was New Year's Eve of 2020. We did it in LA and it was great. It was really good, but it was the first My Machines. It was meant to be the test and we were going to do it in 2020 anyway. you know, 2020 and all the things. So
yeah, right.
We were like, let's yeah, don't speak about that. Then we were like, no, we got to do this. We got to do this tour. So we decided to just to run it in 2022. And it was different because I was bringing this tour to a country where, you know, I only started touring in 2018. Maybe a lot of people didn't know the music maybe before then. So
right.
It's kind of risky to then like dig into your catalog way, way back and play something from like 2013. Cause people might be like, what is this? Like, you know, without the context of it, it sounds really weird. So I ended up doing like a bunch of like edits and flips and stuff. But yeah, the set was really cool. They were kind of like extended sets to 2 hours to 2.5 hours long. All of Kyle Watson. And yeah, it was really fun to play those shows and to watch people like react in ways that I didn't think they would to tracks that I thought they maybe wouldn't have even known.
Well, I think you kind of, I mean, you were kind of an advantage to do it after the pandemic too, because on the one hand, you have like a bunch of new ravers that just discovered dance music during the pandemic who had never been anywhere before. So they're all coming out. And on the other hand, you have these same people who are just being exposed to dance music, and you remember the beginning of your exposure, you just sucked everything in. Like, crowds these days are just more willing for DJs to take risks and to play those weird records, because it's like they're all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and new.
Yeah, I think you're right. Actually, it's a good point, because I was actually having this discussion with someone just earlier this morning, and it's like, I think you can get away with a lot more now, like, you know, different tempos, different genres, stuff like that. I mean, yeah, if I look at like some of the biggest acts that are playing now, and I like, you know, pop up on my Instagram, and they'll be playing like tech house, like vocal tech house. And then like all of a sudden the next slide, they're playing like, you know, dubstep. And then like I'll flip through like slide six and there's like a drum and bass track. And then in between, it's like all tech house. So I think like, and people are just going off for it all. So I think that that's like hyper exciting, because, you know, I think if you're willing to take the risks, like the payoff can be pretty big now. And I mean, there's like, there's nothing better than like taking a risk in front of a crowd and everyone being like up for that, you know, that experience. So it's cool. I'm quite excited to see like what's actually going to be happening to the scene over the next like couple years.
Yeah, no, I think we're entering like a new golden age of dance music. And the fact that like it's bigger now than it ever has been, I'm here for it, because I always wanted it to get this big. Like, underground was fun, don't get me wrong. Underground is always going to be great. But I do love to see it getting mainstream acceptance and people being like, oh, this thing that you've been doing for the last 25 years, oh, yeah, that stuff is kind of cool.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I told you.
But I've been saying this. You should have listened to me back then. But glad to have you.
Yeah, I'm excited to see it. I mean, you can already see it getting very, very big. So yeah, I think there will always be like there always has been and there always will be like that underground element where the new stuff really gets like tested, you know, and bubbles under and stuff, and then
yeah,
that kind of like moves to the mainstream, and then that becomes mainstream, and then, you know, underground finds something new. I think that's the important relationship, right? Like the playoff between the underground and like the more mainstream stuff. But it's very cool to see like mainstream crowds being open to hearing tech house, dubstep, and drum and bass in one set, you know, for example.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So I got two more questions before we do the speed round. The first one is, I want to talk about your Red Alert remix. Because, you know, that's one of those songs that has so many snippets. Like, the bass line is like recognizable. The vocal is recognizable. Everything about that record, for however long it's been around, still people just know that to this day. I want to find out, one, you almost got an official release of it, and then you ended up putting out for free. I kind of want to understand like how that happened, because at one point you were like, oh, it's about to come out. And then you're like, oh, sorry, guys, it's not coming out. And then you're like, oh, it's about to come out, and then it's not coming out. And then you put it out for free. How did all of it happen?
It's like, I have PTSD from that. So you're bringing up some big memories here, dude. Yeah, no, I'll give you the short version. So it came about basically, like, my wife and I were driving around and I was like, man, I really want to flip something old, you know, and do like a bootleg of something that's old. So I was like, Tash, like, find a playlist on Spotify, you know, like 90s dance or something, or 90s electronic, let's listen to it. And it was like, track two was Red Alert. And I was like, bruh, there we go. So, yeah, I mean, it was never official. It was never intended to be official.
Right.
So that was like the start off point, right? But I finished it and I played it out a few times and I sent it to Chris Lake, and he loved it and he played it out for a long time. And he was like, listen, if you can get like this cleared, like, I would love it for Black Book, his record label.
Yeah.
So that's when I was like, okay, let's try. And so I spoke to like my music agent, and she started jumping onto, like, you know, doing all of the admin type of stuff, and everything was looking kind of good. And it was looking like it was going to happen. And then like something came up and then it wouldn't happen. And then, you know, I played it out for a little bit longer, and then like Black Book would get involved and they would try and do something, and then we would get close and then it would be like, oh, sorry, no, like five steps back, it's not going to happen. And then in the middle of all of this negotiation, and now this is like over the course of months, you know, and that's why I'm like,
right,
okay, like, this is going to come out. Okay, this is not going to come out. This is going to come out. Oh, this is not going to come out. And right before it felt like we were about to get to like an end point, the label actually released, and I still don't know why they didn't tell us, but they just released like a remix pack of Red Alert, just like totally coincidentally, you know, to me. Like, I had no idea that it was coming or whatever. Anyway, like four remixes of Red Alert came out on Atlantic Jacks, and I was like, oh, okay, well, I mean, that's like, you can't put it out now. There's no way that this can be official now.
No.
And so I was like, you know, after all of this, it's one of those records that people have been asking me about, like, constantly. Let's just put it out for free. And I'm glad I did, because if I hadn't done that, it literally would just be here on my hard drive in the hands of like maybe five DJs, and that'd be it. So that's the short story.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's interesting that you say that too, though, because like putting it out, you don't want to hold things back like that. Like, there's a lot of people now that feel like they have to hold on to these ideas forever and ever, and it's nice to have it out into the world. I also think it's funny that you mentioned Chris and Black Book with that, because he went through a similar thing with How's Your Evening So Far, and 3 years later, that record, the only people that have it are the few people that happen to get it on promo. Like, the week before it was intended to come out, and it never did. And you know, that's good and it's bad. I don't know, but I'm glad that you put it out, because you know, everybody wanted it.
Yeah, I felt like that had to happen. With Red Alert, that How's Your Evening So Far record. Yeah, I think it was probably a very similar situation where it was like backwards and forwards, because you know, when you get involved with like major labels and you talk about getting things cleared and all of that stuff, there's honestly so much red tape. There's so many people involved. There's so many writers involved. Like, even just with this Dom Dolla and MK record, that Rhyme Dust track, like Dom was like very open about, you know, how complicated it was, that there were like, I don't know, maybe there were more than 10 writers on that record, I think. And that, you know, everybody has to be involved. Every writer has a team, you know, blah, 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 blah. So it's like, it just makes it so, so complicated. So, you know, the whole sampling thing, or yeah, I guess sampling is like a, it's risky, but like the payoff is very big, but you got to be prepared to like deal with some serious admin stuff.
Yeah. That's the thing though. I don't think anybody knows. Everybody's just like, put it on Spotify. And I'm like, yeah, you can't really do that. That's not how the music industry works. I mean, you could, but then what happens when you get in trouble?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's like, and fair enough, because I mean, not everybody understands how the industry works and everything like that, and understand, you know, the rights and where they belong and how complicated it is, like behind the scenes to get things cleared and stuff. So, you know, I don't blame people for going, I'll just put it on Spotify, and then get kind of like frustrated when it doesn't pop up on Spotify. All you can do is really try your hardest to just get it out. Yeah.
100%. I'm gonna like switch gears real fast and talk about things that you do outside of music. And I found it interesting that I saw you doing like flips on water skis. The things that you find when you do research, I'm like, wow, you're seriously going for it. Do you still do that?
I haven't done that. I mean, if I try to do that now, I would probably break my back. I did that. That was wakeboarding. So I did that for...
Okay.
Yeah, I did that for 8 to 10 years competitively. And I mean, I was serious about it. You know, we used to go like every weekend to the lake and ride. My brother and I were both into it, and we had like a group of friends who was like, it was just like all very centered around that. So for a long time in my life, that was like weekends. It was like, go ride, get better, learn new tricks, do like, you know, national champs. We even went to like to world champs and everything. But I stopped riding like, I must have been maybe like 17 or 18 years old when I stopped doing it like,
yeah,
competitively. Yeah, probably 18 or 19. So from when I was about like 10 or 11, I kind of got into it and stopped around then. But yeah, that was good fun. That was a time when you didn't have to really worry about anything. Just went to school during the week. On the weekend, yeah, just went and did flips on the lake. Like...
Wow, I didn't realize I took it back that far.
Yeah. No, so that's why I said, like, all right, you know, in my brain, I'm probably like, dude, I could 100% do that again. But my body would be like, that's not happening.
No, don't. Please don't. For the love of God, please don't try it.
No.
So we're going to get into the speed round now. Are you ready?
Yeah, let's go.
All right. No need to be speedy, but I just call it that because it's for lack of other things to call it. So what's something that's socially acceptable in South Africa that people might find odd in the States?
Oh, I don't know. So, I don't know. I actually can't think of it. I mean, you know, like in Australia, you know, they'll use like the C word, and that's like an endearing term. Like,
yes.
In South Africa, there's a word for it as well. You could kind of get away with saying that stuff and not being too heavily judged.
That's a good one.
Wearing flip-flops into the store, or like actually no shoes. Even some people don't wear any shoes into like stores and stuff. I mean, I wouldn't say everybody does.
Oh, that.
I wouldn't say that's necessary.
But that's also definitely something that people just don't do in the States at all. Like,
yeah.
I mean, maybe some parts.
South Africa, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird. In South Africa, we have like 11 official languages, so it's like a very interesting country. Yeah.
Yeah. Biltong, yes or no?
Yes, obviously. What the hell are you talking about, man? Have you ever had biltong?
I mean, it's not as an acquired taste as like, huh? Oh yeah, no, I've been to South Africa before.
You know,
I have a friend whose aunt lives there, so we went there and visited after New Year's for 2 weeks 1 year. So biltong, yes, biltong. I've had biltong; it's delicious.
Where we live here in the UK, there is like a dude who, I know this is supposed to be a speed round, but like I'm getting carried away. Yeah, there's a dude in like the mall near us who's from South Africa. He has a little biltong stand, and we love frequenting the biltong stand.
I love to hear it. Analog or digital?
Digital.
Ooh.
Digital.
Biggie or Tupac?
Honestly, I'm not huge into hip hop, so I would say probably Biggie because I know more of the, or I've heard more of the music. But I have to admit.
Fair enough.
I have to admit I'm not like a huge hip hop head.
That's okay. You don't have to be.
Yeah, don't judge me, please.
I'm not judging you, at least not for that. If I looked at your recently played tunes on Spotify, what would you want to hide?
Oh, I thought you were going to say, what would I see? Damn. I was getting pumped.
Yeah, I want to know what's yours.
Oh, man. Old Blink-182. I don't know if that's embarrassing or not. Because to me, that's like pretty badass.
No, I wouldn't say it's embarrassing. And you know, you just went to Coachella. They played. It makes sense. So I'll give you that. But also, since you mentioned it, what would I see that you're excited about?
System of a Down. Slipknot. Queens of the Stone Age.
You're a metalhead.
Yeah.
You're a metalhead rocker.
I'm big into rock. Yeah. I mean, like I say Blink 182 because around the time I was wakeboarding, that was like literally the soundtrack of my teenage years. I listened to like a lot of that stuff, Toxicity, Francis Babadan and like Chevelle and all of those guys. But then at the same time, like I'm flipping between like Skrillex's new stuff, old Deftones, you know, all of that good stuff.
I love that. I love it. What sound or noise do you love?
The coffee machine.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen every video you're drinking a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's the thing. I'd probably drink too much coffee. Although I've said that to people and they've been like, you know, no, I have like double that in a day. But yeah, I do like a coffee. I think it's not really the sound that the coffee machine makes and more about, you know, the fact that I'm going to be drinking a coffee soon.
I love that. It's the anticipation. Mm. If you weren't a musician, what would you be?
Realistically, I'd probably be a video editor. Yeah.
And you were.
And I was. Yeah. And I was. And yeah. I still do that stuff, you know, for myself and everything. So yeah, realistically, probably that. I do kind of like the idea of trading as well. So maybe I would have been a trader.
Nice. 808 or 909?
909.
Nice. Vegas or Miami?
I would say Miami. We've been to Vegas a few times and it really, if you've been there a few times, you've done Vegas. Like there, you know, there's a few things that you can do in Vegas and that's that.
If you've been there once, you've been there enough.
I'm glad you said it.
Yeah. Chris Lake or Carl Cox?
Chris Lake, dude. Come on.
What's worse, random people you haven't spoken to in years hitting you up for guest lists or a hangnail?
A hangnail?
Yeah.
I mean, dude,
Which one is worse?
I actually, you know, I have a very bad habit of giving myself hangnails. So I would say...
Okay.
I would say people who haven't spoken to me in years, hitting me up, pretending to be my friend, asking for guest lists would be way worse.
All right. Intimate club or festival?
Intimate club.
Intimate club or rave? Oh.
No. It's fine. Intimate club. I like...
Oh.
You know, I like... So one of the things that I love the most about performing and stuff is when you can really connect with the crowd. And it's very hard to do that when you're at a festival. A lot of people are not necessarily there to see you. They just pull in. They're like, okay, cool. Like, this is dope. Music's cool. They don't know who you are or whatever. At an intimate club, if you're playing at a club with 500 people or whatever, and it's like a hard ticketed situation, 500 people have bought tickets to come see you. Like, they are there for you. And you feel much more of a connection.
Right.
When you're in a smaller space, people are closer to you. Like I prefer being like maybe just a head or two heads above the crowd. Like I don't like being, it's not that I don't like it. Like, you know, of course, like playing something like Coachella or Ultra or whatever. Like, I mean, those are amazing experiences, but you don't have the same connection with people that you do at an intimate club. So both are fun. But if I had to choose, I would have 500 people going crazy in a small room with a loud, like loud sound system over 2,000, 3,000 people, or like an open air situation at a festival.
I 100% agree with that. You couldn't have got it more right. And then final question, finish this sentence. House music is?
Medicine for the Soul.
Ooh, that was a fucking fantastic way to end things. Well done.
Yeah.
Well done.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak to us today. I really appreciate it. This was fantastic, and we're really looking forward to having you.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate it. And yeah, I'm so, so pumped for the show. Honestly, I actually cannot wait. I've heard amazing things about the venue, and yeah, the announcement really well. So I'm very, very excited to show you guys, you know, what's been cooking in the kitchen.